Okay, moving on to the disclosure initiative. Am I handing over to you, Catherine?
You are. Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. So, as you know, we are partway through testing our guidance for the board about how it can develop and draft disclosure requirements more effectively in future. And we're testing that guidance on two standards, being IAS 19 and IFRS 13. So today's meeting is all about pension disclosures. We've got two papers for you on IAS 19, which Aisha will walk you through in just a minute. In terms of where we are in the bigger picture on the project, if the board is able to reach conclusion on all of the questions that we have for you today, we don't have any further IAS 19 topics to bring, so this will end our technical discussions on pensions. Next month, in February, we're planning to bring one remaining specific topic on IFRS 13. We're also planning to bring a paper which summarises all of the lessons we've learnt throughout the testing process and some thoughts about whether the board should make refinements to its draft guidance and whether those refinements might affect our upcoming due process document. If that February meeting was also conclusive, we would then be planning to ask you in March for permission to ballot an exposure draft. So, hoping that the board is feeling energetic and decisive this afternoon, and I will hand over to Aisha.
Or on the energetic front.
So, agenda paper 11A. So at the July 2019 meeting, the board tentatively decided to include six specific disclosure objectives on defined benefit plans. Subsequently, at the November 2019 meeting, the board made tentative decisions about the items of information to meet five of those objectives. So agenda paper 11A for today focuses on the last specific disclosure objective, which is about expected future cash flows for defined benefit plans. The board's tentative decision is that this objective, which an entity would specifically be required to comply with, should not capture expected future cash flows for obligations that do not yet exist at the end of the period. The board made this decision in light of the guidance in the conceptual framework. However, as we describe in paragraph 14 of the paper, the board asked the staff to consider how to incorporate users' underlying needs to understand the total expected cash flows as part of the items of information to associate with the objective. Paragraphs 18 to 24 discuss the items of information that directly meet the objective. Based on feedback from outreach, we recommend that the board identify the narrative and quantitative items of information in paragraphs 16 and 24, respectively, as ways in which an entity may satisfy the objective. Paragraph 25 to 35 of the paper then discuss items of information that go beyond the objective but present an effective way to satisfy user overall needs in this area. These items would essentially offer an entity the possibility of presenting a more holistic picture about their expected future cash flows instead of limiting the information to future cash flows for the obligation that exists at the reporting period, at the end of that period, rather. At the November meeting, some board members raised concerns about including such items of information. We've acknowledged those concerns in the paper. However, for the reasons that we describe in paragraph 34, we think it would be reasonable to incorporate those items of information. Therefore, we recommend that the board also identify the items of information in paragraph 31 of the paper as additional ways that an entity could satisfy the objective. Furthermore, we think it would be helpful to include application guidance in IAS 19 that would explain how an entity applies judgment to determine when the set of items of information would be relevant in its own circumstances. Paragraph 35 provides examples of what that application guidance could include. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to you to discuss and vote on the questions for the board, which ask whether you agree with our staff recommendations, which are summarized in paragraphs 43 and 44 of the paper.
Françoise?
Thank you, and I support the staff recommendation. The comment I would like to make is that when I read the analysis, until I got to paragraph 34 and saw the detail of what you were proposing. You were giving me the feeling that you were asking more than we should. And I started to shake and say, no, I disagree. But then when I looked at the detail that you ask, basically I think you really end up with requirements that explain the numbers which are presented in financial statements and provide supplementary information in order to help others project future cash flows. We're not stepping into the domain of providing forward-looking information. It's just elements of information that exist that help project. So I don't think you have taken a more holistic view than you should. I think you're right up where we should be. And I support.
Mary?
I had one suggested tweak in respect of paragraph 22, which is, this is talking about narrative information particularly related to future funding. And you give an example of the entity has agreed alternative means by which the DBO will be addressed in the future. And I think I would just maybe step back and characterize this as provide narrative information regarding how any current asset shortfall, so if the plan is not fully funded, how any current asset shortfall is expected to be met. Contribution, change in payment, payments to the beneficiaries, or changes in investment strategies are three examples. But it's just, I think if you have an obligation that's greater than the asset, what we're saying is asking the entity to provide a narrative discussion rather than explicit quantitative amounts about the means, if any, it has identified for addressing that shortfall. It felt here, and then I guess when you get to paragraph 43, maybe a bit going into too specific an example about the investment strategy. I'd rather put that in the context of there being the plan not being fully funded, which is a normal situation to be in, that the plan is not fully funded.
So, sorry, Mary, are you feeling that you would need an amendment to the recommendation, or do you feel the wording is sort of, it gives you enough understanding of the drafting point, or is there?
How do you map paragraph 22 to paragraph 43?
It's 43BI.
So I think it's probably think about the wording tweak rather than change in the recommendation.
Okay. Thank you. So I'm sure we can remember that better information about cash flows was probably the number one request that came out from our research with you in terms of relation to the pension liability. So I do support, I like the rewording of the disclosure objective that you've got in paragraph 43. I think that's helpful. I stand by the fact that I think most users say disaggregation is important of that. I know that's taking us into forward-looking territory. And I'm happy we can try and give some steer-through application guidance. I accept that that's not feasible, as you say, for all jurisdictions. So I think that I'm happy with that. I think it's important if we can actually highlight that where it's plausible, it's helpful to users in the application guidance. I guess if I look at the illustrative examples that you've included in the appendix, the only thing I'd note there is all three of those don't do any disaggregation. I just wonder whether there's scope for actually including one that did some disaggregation, just by way of encouragement.
Yes, I mean, just For the avoidance of doubt, these examples are provided for the purpose of the paper, so any examples that ultimately found their way into a due process document would, you know, be subject to further discussion, review, etc. With regard to your suggestion, there's absolutely no reason why we couldn't do that. I mean, we were quite careful to include information in these examples that we felt could be helpful to all jurisdictions, irrespective of the particular information that they had. So that was the rationale for including and excluding what we did. But we will certainly think about whether we can feasibly do that as we move forward.
I've got one high-level comment and then a couple of very specific suggestions. So my high-level comment, and I've had a discussion with you, so it's no surprise, is I don't object to where we're landing, and, in fact, I can see the usefulness of the information that we may be sort of indirectly encouraging people to provide if it's relevant to their investors, that looks beyond the sort of strict items that link to what's recognised on the balance sheet and goes beyond that. But I guess I have just a general sort of feeling of unease, I guess, that on the one hand that we're saying that the way that the words are written, it only requires an entity to disclose information that links back to the defined benefit obligations that exist at the reporting date. But then on the other hand, we're saying, but if you read the words and you feel that it would be relevant to actually opine on a broader population and you think that would be useful information, then, you know, go ahead and that's fine. And that, to me, is just a little bit of a disconnect, particularly in the context of trying to have objectives that are enforceable, because we're sort of saying these are what the words mean, but if you feel that actually a different reading of the words that would apply to a bigger population would be a good set of information, then please feel free to read those words in a different way. Now, that to me just feels, maybe I'm nervous I'm going to get an interpretation committee question on this in the future about what do the words actually mean. Did we mean narrow or did we mean broad? And I can see that we're not going to object to this outcome. And I think what we are sort of acknowledging, I think, is that if push comes to shove, a regulator can only enforce the narrower reading, but somebody could do something which would probably be better information. But it just seems odd to say, actually, these words we think mean this, but you can read them slightly differently if you think that would be good. And that, to me, is just a little bit of an anathema in our book with our requirements. And so I just have a sense of unease about that. Doesn't mean I hate the outcome. It just seems odd to me. As a sort of an idea. Having said that, I'm not going to puke all over it because there's nothing in here that's, you know, the worst idea in the world. I just, like, it seems weird to me. And I tried for ages to try and think of an analogy that was sort of help articulate what I meant, and I only could come up with a stupid one, but so I haven't come up with a better one, so I'll continue with my stupid one, which is that, say, for some reason we were obsessed about apples, and so we required people to provide information on their balance sheet and to recognise information about apples, but no other fruit. But a company comes along and it decides that actually it thinks its investors should know about all of its fruit exposure, so they provide information about fruit. So they've come along and read our requirements reading fruit. We meant apples, and we just say, well, that's okay. But we cared about apples in particular, and we're not going to get that. So it just seems odd, but I can let that go. What I do think is important, and my two specific points are, I don't object to the idea that we have in here as well that, you know, it may not be possible to disaggregate. It would be better, I think, to be able to disaggregate the stuff that relates to the recognised and the other, so you've got a better chance of making comparisons. And I think somewhere else we talk about the fact that in paragraph 18, I think it was, that there could be different ways for determining the basis for which you're coming up with the numbers, and we're not going to specify which. I'm sort of could live with both of those things from a practicability perspective, but I think what it would be good to do would be to make it necessary for an entity to explain what they did, so at least you know whether the number you're looking at is an aggregation of the stuff that relates to what's recognised plus other stuff, or it's limited to what's recognised, or what the basis is for how you've come up with the numbers in that paragraph 18 situation, so you at least know what comparisons you can and can't make entity to entity. So give them flexibility, but at least tell us what's going on. The other thing I think we just need to be a little bit careful of in the context of this whole objective-based approach is in a few places in the paper, and I completely am fine with it the way that I think you mean it, but I think we need to be careful that it doesn't get overread by people as we try and train them onto this objective-based wording to test it. In a few places we talk about being too prescriptive because we need to make sure that it's that we're requiring information or that people are putting together information that's realistic for them to prepare. I think what we have to be very careful about is to make sure that they can't just say, well, it's not realistic for me to prepare information about my IAS 19 plans, full stop. You mean you have to meet the objectives, but we'll let you decide what is, you know, the best way for you in terms of what's practical and useful information to meet the objective, but you have to meet the objective. I think we have to be careful that we don't bandy the words realistic to prepare around so much that people think that means they can get out of disclosures altogether. Because if I'd said to people, these are my IFRS 16 disclosures, they might have said, well, it's not realistic for me to prepare that because those systems changes are so big, and that's not what you mean. So I think we just need to be careful how we use those words. I don't know whether you had any reactions to my first point.
Yes, I'm going to try and be brief. One thing I will say that I think needed a response was your point about explanation of what has been done. We'd have no issue with including that. I think that would make sense. So we'd be happy if the board wanted to take questions on that basis. With regard to your first point, and also sort of coming back to what Francois said, we are quite comfortable that ultimately what this proposal does is not require anything that is so far removed from what's on the financial statements at year end that, you know, it gives us serious concern. At the same time, you know, we are walking a fine line between the remit within which we operate and getting the best possible information. And after, you know, much debate with you guys and much work behind the scenes, we do feel that this is the best walk of that line. So yep. Fully understanding your point, I think it's fair.
I did mean to say, actually, that it's no offence to you because we did ask you to square the circle. And I think you have done quite a good job of squaring the circle, but I just think we've come up with a little bit of a weird outcome. But Rika?
Thank you, Sue. Hi. Firstly, I appreciate the staff effort to revise the guidance to clarify the two-part extent of disclosure is now required. And because I expressed a concern of this specific requirement in a November meeting, but now I support the staff proposal, but I think if I'm reading this objective, I have no basis about arguing the wording and expression, but still the preparer might have a question about to what extent of the information can meet this objective, even though they also can look at 1, 2, 3, 4 or B. So I truly think your scenarios, three scenarios plus example in Appendix A, seems very helpful to understand what the reasonable level of the information is required to the entity to prepare to explain. So,
Chin Chao?
Yep. Generally, I support the staff's proposal. I think it's a very good proposal. I just have two comments or clarify further. First, about management, management's expectation and forecast. Currently, we are proposing that require entity to disclose those quantitative information about future contribution to meet the defined benefit contribution obligation, not only based on agreements and policies, but also based on the management expectation and forecast. Because I'm a little bit concerned about the expectation and the forecast, whether it's too soft, too flexible, or subjective. And when I look through your analysis in paragraph 19, where we say the forecast, approved forecast, So it adds some discipline on those forecasts. So I'm thinking that whether it could add some discipline on management expectation and forecast, such as approved forecast, or such as, I remember in IAS 36 impairment statement, in order to calculate the value value in use, the company needed to use future financial forecast, but it needed to be approved by management. So I think maybe this kind of discipline can help and provide more reliable useful information to users. Otherwise, it's too flexible. Or maybe we change it with such as, I think the example you're giving very helpful. For example, first example actually, say the company actually has a plan, not only the expectation and the forecast. So whether it could be based on the management plan or management approved forecast or approved future budget, this kind of thing. I think preparers will feel very helpful, and also auditor think that it could be auditable. And the second question, just to clarify, paragraph 44, the second proposal you proposed, you're going to include some explanatory application guidance. I'm not sure what the meaning of those. This is the application guidance, or like illustrated examples include appendix A, X. What kind of?
So we would envisage application guidance as in B paragraphs of the standard. So application guidance in the standard sense. Yes, and it would be really because we think with this topic more than anything else we've discussed on this project, the level of discussion that we have had to get to a place of comfort with the proposals has been, you know, quite significant and extremely beneficial. And we think for companies in applying these proposals, understanding some of the thought that's gone into why those four bullet points exist and the circumstances in which one or other might be more helpful to users or more appropriate would make the proposals significantly easier to apply. So we think this is a case where it would be helpful to do that.
Gary?
I agree with the recommendations in this paper and completely agree with Nick. The most important focus is on cash into the plan or whatever. But building on what Jin Chow said up in paragraph 19, 19A, I think I do agree they can generally be managed. I think under 19A, I sort of took the what doesn't come through, what sort of time horizon? Pensions are, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 year propositions. If you're just talking the next 12 months as opposed to what's reasonably predictable, I think the world's going to come back and comment on what time horizon you're talking about. And not sure what to do, if anything to do with that right now, but that's going to come back at us. I think you're seeing a lot of this stuff is based on forecast and assumptions and judgments. But Jin Chow would hit on it. The approved forecast, well, what does that mean? Sometimes it's a staff analysis that the CFO says, yep, I can live with the total answer. I'm not worried about the details, you know, about it. I hit my cash flow targets in total. This is just another liability to deal with, no more or less important than any other obligation I've got to pay for balance sheet. So I would be somewhat, I would use, say, approved might be, maybe that's what we want, but I think you're going to get narrower as opposed to what do you expect, you know, type thing. So I think we need to be careful on how that's articulated in it. The other thing, when we talk about the funding the liability that exists at a point in time on the balance sheet, pension funding is typically exists inside minimum floors and maximum funding. And there's a lot of discretion in between there. What do you do? And what looks really good now or promising now can be very different 15 months from now. And if you've got think of the flexibility, if you've got, even if it's an underfunded plan, But if you've got enough plan assets at the moment to pay the next 15 years worth of pension payments, it's only in year 16 you start worrying about running out of cash. You got 14 years to do something about it. So I think tying it to the balance sheet and what you're funding might be a little bit too precise given the circumstance. And again, just like our own tax returns things, even when you're working these things on a timely basis, your funding still might be 2 years after the fact of the balance sheet that you're trying to chew up. So again, I would advise to be somewhat broader in here. If you get try to be precise, I think you'll run the risk of losing it because people will apply it precisely. But in fact, you're looking for a general ambiance of what do you expect to do over the next several years. I think that's what we're after here. If you're closing your books correctly, is you should always at least know what the next 12 months is because you got to have a current non-current splits on the balance sheet. For unfunded plans, or it's just more like payroll, you probably know what you're going to pay. The funding is probably at the end of the year, probably is your best estimate for the next 12 months. And the real auditability is either the recent past or it's a management representation. Like there really is not much in between.
Mary?
Sue, I wanted to come back to your point about the Apple's disclosure. And I'm going to step back and say one of the things that I can't remember in which project, we went back and looked at encouraged versus required disclosures. And the overall lesson we learned is when we lob encouraged but not required disclosures into things, they can confuse or be misunderstood and cause some unnecessary debates about noncompliance, and that they very rarely are provided. So I think we need to be really clear about what is, what we think is part of the overall specific disclosure objective versus, we've learned a tremendous amount from the outreach with users and about how they would value this additional information that we are deciding that we are not going to require. And I think we really, really want to share that extra knowledge we have because it can help the people who want to give the best information. But I think we have to think really hard about whether we convey that extra learning in the document, in something that is otherwise required specific objectives or not. And whether if we say, listen, it's a really good point, we want to make sure we communicate this for those who want to do, be the A star students, but I think we should not commingle it with the things we are setting out as the specifically required objectives. And it's not that I want to discourage it. I think, people, if they know, and especially if it's available because they get the information on a combined basis, they shouldn't in any way be discouraged from doing that. And we might want to try and highlight that it would be useful. But I think we have to be really clear about what is. We learned that this would be really nice. We decided we couldn't require it, but we want to make sure you're aware how valuable it can be to users of financial statements from. These are the things that we are focusing on in the specific disclosure objectives. So I'm a bit worried about, any mushiness in that area. And maybe the way to come at it is to say the specific disclosure requirement is about the recognized DBO, defined benefit obligation. In some jurisdictions, you may have this information combining both existing and future. If so, that may be, talking about under what circumstances would it be possible to satisfy the objective providing on a combined basis, and do we think it's necessary that they be able to disaggregate that in some way, at least, with some kind of qualitative information, significant, virtually all, or it's about 50-50, kind of thing. Because otherwise you've got eight entities saying, here's the information about our recognized DBO, and somebody else saying, here's the information on a combined basis. Now, when we're talking about liabilities, there's probably a pretty good built-in incentive for a company, an entity, to make clear that they're talking about the bigger pot. But if Sue's Apple disclosure was focused on really valuable assets, if somebody decided to read it as a disclosure requirement about all the fruit they held and they weren't really crystal clear, about it being their entire fruit basket, not just their apples, then it would make them sound, you know, make them sound like they, you know, they're a lot better off, even if they're clear. I mean, I think, so my comment about this point is, I understand our desire to communicate the learnings we've had. If we've made a decision not to encompass information about unrecognized DBO in the scope of the specific disclosure objective that we have, then I think we shouldn't fuzz that, you know, make it, you know, try to merge the two things, and let's think about how we clearly communicate that additional learning point. Because I think then we just get into, in the old world, required versus encouraged disclosures and risk muddying the message.
This paper helped me a lot to understand, I think, what you wanted to have, because in the past I was concerned about, okay, that we would require exact tables of future cash flows expected out of this defined benefit plan, or even if it is not current defined benefit plans or the future obligation. And my understanding is also from this kind of the proposed specific disclosure and the example that it is not that we want to distinguish between future cash flows from defined benefit obligation which exists at reporting date. It is a kind of, you have also the ability, if I think in certain circumstances, if you describe law and regulations, also which I think apply to future cash flows, that with that will fulfill this kind of cash flow requirements and information. So it is not distinguished between cash flows from existing benefits. It's a kind of, you have several opportunities how to can make this kind of disclosure, which is important for investors. And my thought was, okay, it is not about specific numbers of cash flows. It is a kind of, is there some unusual requirements for the future regarding my cash flows, which I have to contribute to this plan? That is, at least from my reading of the examples of the specific and the objective, that is my outcome. So I'm not so concerned, which I was in the past, that people said, okay, you have to come up with detailed tables of future cash flows, which I think clearly is of interest, but why is that required for a defined benefit obligation? Why not for insurance obligations? Because I think also if you would ask an analyst of an insurance companies, I would prefer maybe the estimate of our current future cash flows, or do you want to have all the cash flows which the company is using for that? Clearly, you would, maybe would say, I want to have the cash flows. But here I think it is a kind of more, I see the kind of unusual things. Do you plan to contribute, to fund? When do you plan? And this kind of stuff which is not in normal course of business. It's a kind of, it's difficult to estimate from the pure number, and therefore you provide this additional information. But overall, as I said, that helped me a lot, and that is why I'm agree and support the staff recommendation.
When I expressed my support, I started to say that I had been very uneasy about the way the analysis was developed, because it seemed to me that it was leading to a different outcome from what we have as recommendations. I don't see in the requirements that are proposed the objective which on which the requirement is based, and the detailed list of items that can have the potential of helping meet the objective. I don't see anything like encouragement, a narrow or wide bucket depending on whether it's the information that you have or the information that you wish to provide. I see something that really channeled me into, I need to provide the information which is available to me that has the potential of giving a steer as to how the future cash flows are going to materialize, and I provide quantitative information to understand the defined benefit obligation at the reporting date, what I have reported in my accounts. And I think it's, and my support comes from the clarity of this recommendation and articulation between the objective and much more, and from what I have in various paragraphs that to me made me first expect something that I would not have supported. So to me there was a form of kind of, you know, And I think it's natural in the analysis that you start from what you've heard, and you really assess whether this is feasible or not. And so you let us wander eventually on tracks that ultimately you don't put us on. But so,
can I respond to that? Because I don't think we're actually in that dissimilar place, even though we probably sound like we're saying very different things. Because ultimately, when I read the words at the end, particularly if I read the words at the end in the context of the paragraph 11, which says that the staff think that these words mean you only have to focus on the recognised amounts, to use shorthand, I agree with you. That seems fine, clear, enforceable, and we all know what we're going to get. But I think, and I'm sort of putting words in your mouth, so I throw them back out again if they're not the appropriate words, the sense I got from the paper, which I think is also the sense you got from the paper, is in a way the staff, at least I think, are sort of thinking that there will be circumstances where it would be relevant to actually do more, and so they wouldn't be unhappy for somebody to pick up these words and to think more broadly about their broader pension obligations using the same sorts of parameters and to potentially build those into the disclosures. So it's not what's required, but it could be an aspiration. And so I think this is to Mary's point. If we actually say, if we actually meant as a board and agreed with the staff that we want to require the thing that focuses on what's actually recognised, but we've acknowledged that there is a relevance in other information which might be good to provide, should we just say those two separate things? One is what we're being asked to vote on, which is sort of the stuff that's linked to what's actually recognised, which is, I think, what the staff recommendation specifically requires. But do we want to do something specific to acknowledge that there's another layer of information? And the reason I had my card up was actually slightly different, which I'll throw in there. What I think would be troubling to me would be, and I was going to ask you what your intention was in terms of what's in the application guidance, because where I think it would get really muddy would be if the words that we had focused on the recognised amounts, but the examples we had in the application guidance started to introduce the broader picture, then I think we'd have a real internal disconnect between our two sets of messaging. But is your idea to keep the application guidance focused on the recognised stuff?
Can I comment a bit more broadly on your and Mary's thoughts before trying to answer that question? I personally would be quite nervous about having a very distinct, you are required to disclose the stuff that is literally cash flows relating to the obligation at year end, and then separately, if you want to disclose some other stuff as well. For me, that would not work, and the reason we'd be back in encouraged disclosures land. There'd almost be no point in doing that because no one would disclose the second bit. The reason this is quite a special case is, coming back to your orchard, apples will do and is well within the remit within which we all work. Everything is better than apples, but you can have a debate about, you know, whether everything is within that remit, and everything disclosed into apples and things that are separate from apples is awesome. But the problem with all of this is that the holistic basis on which entities themselves are thinking about the future cash flow effects of their pension schemes is not, you know, in every respect going to have that straight sort of bright line splitting those things. I would also add that In terms of doing the recommendation in this way, what we are not envisaging and what we don't think any company would ever even consider doing is bringing in like things like, to take an extreme example, if they're planning to increase their employee numbers in future and how would that affect pension cash flows. That's absolutely off the table because that is completely irrelevant to what's in the obligation at year end. But to the extent that the calculations and the actuarial assumptions and such that are helping entities to arrive at how they think about the cash flow effects are done on a holistic basis. That's my everything in the orchard, and that everything is better than just the apples. And the way we've tried to develop our recommendation is so that you have to explain that stuff, because we've got arrangements, we've got policies, we've got agreements. You've got to explain how you've got to where you've got to. We've purposefully put quantitative stuff in, quantitative information about the obligation at the balance sheet date, or if you are going a bit more holistic, we talk about patterns and rates of future contributions, precisely to, you know, encourage entities. It's not boilerplate. To Françoise's earlier point, it's like, what's the best information I have, and give me the numbers that are allowing me as a company to understand and make decisions based on what I expect the cash flow effects to be. But I don't think that going bright line, required, encouraged, would do that.
Can I ask you a question building on the apple and orchard analogy? So if I vote on the staff recommendation, am I voting to require people to provide information about apples, but I'll accept them providing me information about the orchard as a way of meeting the requirement about apples?
Yes, and with your addition that they've got to explain what they've done. And one thing I would add there, in case your questions make me wonder if we maybe need to highlight it, is that, to me, if a company is giving whole orchard, so to speak, they would still be explaining what are the sort of agreements and policies that have got them there. So if that whole orchard is normal sort of payments, but also some deficit reduction, that deficit reduction will have been subject to, you know, agreement with someone. It's not just going to have come out of thin air. So we would expect this to get to a reasonable depiction of what's going on.
And the application guidance, would it illustrate apples or an orchard?
The application guidance would explain precisely why we have got all of that in, and the circumstances in which orchard might be a better answer than apples, and why.
Better answer than apples to meet an apple requirement.
I think the information about the orchard is brought in, provided it informs about apples. Otherwise, it's not.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated orchard. In the sense that, as I said earlier, we would never expect companies to be including stuff like new future employees, which is completely unrelated to apples. But to the extent that they're making holistic calculations of the effect that the scheme that they have now is likely to have on future cash flows, that's kind of like, it's very apple related. I just struggle to draw a bright line between those types of fruits.
Horticultural analogy.
I'm not sure I'll go further with the horticulture, but if I go back and look at paragraph 43, within B, sorry, this is heightening my attention to differences in the drafting. Within B, item small Roman 1 and small Roman 2 are explicit, but their qualifications for those two items only, to meet the defined benefit obligation that exists at the end of the reporting period.
Yep.
Item small Roman 3 and small Roman 4 do not have the obligation. So, as drafted, I think they would require you to consider things that would relate not only to expected future contributions in respect of the recognized DBO, but they would require you, as drafted, to think about expected future contributions in respect of the unrecognized DBO, because it says at least to the extent known, any known minimum funding, and four would. It is kind of almost an infinite look forward. And in light of our horticultural discussions, I think I would be tempted to suggest that 3 and 4 be drafted. And I mean, I'm falling into the encouraged versus required, but my first objective is clarity, is at least, you know, to say something like description of regulatory other agreements that affect any expected future cash contributions, at least in respect of obligations that exist at the reporting date.
I presume, though, it's drafted, Catherine, you intend 43A to sort of be the overarching, and that links to the balance sheets.
Yeah. Yes. So 43A is the required bit. All the stuff in B is not explicitly required. It's explanation of how you might achieve this. So.
Okay. But A is not limited to exist at the end of the reporting date.
Well, so the reference to defined benefit obligation is how we're linking it to the reporting date. So it's the defined benefit obligation that, that exists at the period end.
So, we're ready to vote. So we're voting on the questions as drafted, but with your clarification about explaining what you've got in there, if you like, whether you've got an orchard or apples. Okay. So with that, can I get a show of hands on question one, whether you agree with the staff recommendation in paragraph 43?
13, one absent.
And whether you agree with the recommendation in 44, so this is the inclusion of explanatory application guidance, so sort of B paragraphs.
13, one absent.
It's going to be scrutinised.
Moving on to agenda paper 11B. So this paper presents our analysis on how the board's decisions on employee benefits so far compares to the disclosure objectives and requirements in IAS 19 and our recommendations on whether those tentative decisions should be refined. This is the last step in the blank page approach that the board decided to take in exploring the information about employee benefits that will more effectively meet stakeholder needs. So the board has made tentative decisions on all types of employee benefits that's covered by IAS 19. I'll tee up our analysis and recommendation on each tentative decision, pausing for board discussion and voting before I move on to the next one. So starting first with defined benefit plans, the board tentatively decided to include one high-level catch-all objective and six specific disclosure objectives for these plans. For the high-level catch-all objective, we think that the board's tentative decisions are similar to the overarching objective in IAS 19 today, but they differ in that the board's tentative decisions use language that's consistent with those in recently issued standards. Furthermore, the overarching objective in IAS 19 today provides a list of features that an entity could disaggregate information about defined benefits plans. We think that the board should refine its tentative decisions about the objective to incorporate those examples so as to be helpful to entities in effectively complying with the objective. So I'll turn it over to the board to discuss and vote on question one, which asks whether the board agrees with our staff recommendation in paragraph 15.
Anne, I just wanted to make a high-level comment, and I'd be interested in your response. All this detailed work has led you to a place where you've been able to show that some of the requirements that were there before are the things that people want to see now. And even where they didn't line up directly, sometimes you'd say, well, they're actually covered. They are covered because they're covered here somewhere else. So my feeling as I looked at the paper in its entirety was that we're using a different approach to try and extract the information, to try and get away from a checklist approach. So people could be providing less text in the future, but hopefully more informative information. But we haven't... I don't think it's going to go out there as a package that looks like we're requiring less disclosure, because it looks like everything we used to do under 19 in the existing standard, people could still do it now. I think in application, though, they if they followed the spirit of this, they would do it differently because they would focus on what's material, what they see is important to their users, that sort of thing. So as long as they understand what we're trying to achieve, they could be producing fewer disclosures that are more relevant. But when you look at this paper, it looks like I know we're not got a list of requirements anymore. We've got objectives and ways you might meet the objective, but the whole package looks like all those things are still there. Is that a fair comment or not?
I wouldn't say it's entirely in accordance with my personal view. So You're right in saying that a lot of the disclosure requirements that exist today, the underlying reason for those existing pertains to something that we've now got. So in terms of what we are sort of aiming for in terms of content, there is a huge amount of crossover. So in that sense, yes, what you've said is absolutely fair. I think the big difference for us, and it kind of comes back all the way to the beginning of the project, is that in reality, when we talk to investors about existing pension notes, they are going through them and saying a lot of it is just not useful. And that's kind of about application of requirements. So as we've gone through our process of really interrogating what's there and why, and separately gone through a process of what do we ideally want and why, the underlying reasons are extremely similar, and therefore when we go through IAS 19 paragraph by paragraph, there's a lot of them where we say, well, actually we've covered this, but whilst it is, you know, not within the remit of the project to sort of talk directly about volume, because our aim is effectiveness, my personal expectation would be that a company applying our proposals, albeit that the proposals themselves will have a lot in them and be quite lengthy, applied properly, I would expect the pages in financial statements devoted to this to be less. Because I think what our proposals do is give the why and allow companies to go, for example, you know, we see a lot of sensitivity analyses that are just prepared in a way that doesn't give investors exactly what they need, whereas if companies can go, well, this is why, and I can give something much more concise that fulfills that need, comparing requirements to requirements, the technical content is very similar, which is the point that you're raising, but I would hate to sit here and say it's the same, because I think there is a fundamental difference. Does that?
Yeah. And so the point is people understanding this is a new approach, not just looking at it and saying, oh, it's just the same as before. I'll just do what I did before.
Yeah.
Because the things look similar, but the whole approach is different. So we have an education task on our hands in making sure people understand it's a different approach. And things that were there before may not be required now when you use the lens that we're asking entities to use.
And I think, to be fair as well, when we actually get round to drafting what the requirements will do, they will look very different to the requirements that we've currently got in 19. So I don't think anybody picking it up would go, oh, hold on a second, I can just do what I did before because actually nothing's changed, because it will look very different in terms of the style and the approach.
Yeah. Thank you.
Tadal?
Thank you, sir. Well, thank you for the paper. I support the staff's proposal. I have just one observation on paragraph 9b. When we allow, the entity may satisfy the disclosure objective by cross-reference to disclosure in another group's entity financial statements that is available to users of financial statements on the same terms. Two observations here. It seems that we are limiting to financial statements. We, in the past, tried to allow some cross-reference to other documents. And, for example, especially in relation to IAS 19, we might have some remunerations report, director's report, that we might also have this information there. But if you want to keep this cross-reference limited to financial statements, that I think is good, I would try to leverage on the text of IFRS 10 that says that financial statements that are available for public use and comply with IFRS. It's just because here it says that on the same terms, it's just, I don't know whether it's what same terms mean. IFRS, for example.
English?
English. Good. It's a good point. It definitely makes difference in transnational, multinational companies. And again, I think that the text that we have in IFRS 10 is good to deal with this type of information available outside the financial statements.
If I may respond We are. I think we're on the last question now, but I think since you've asked it, I'll respond now. And if the, I don't know if the board members prefer to work question by question or ask us all your questions on the paper at the beginning. But on the cross-referencing point, I think before your time on the board today, we did a lot of research on precisely this. And off the back of that, my sort of reading of term was always about making sure that the information is available for as long as the financial statements are available. So you will never get a circumstance where a user picks up a set of financial statements, sees a cross-reference, and that cross-reference no longer exists because the document has gone. So that's always been my reading. And in terms of your point about IFRS, sort of in accordance with IFRS standards, our thinking is that, by definition, the information we're talking about being IAS 19 information, it is IFRS standard information. So we feel like that's there, but equally we'd be happy to consider in drafting. The last thing I'd add is that we are proposing to use the same language that also is in IFRS 7, so that the two cross-referencing points throughout the book are identically worded to avoid confusion.
Okay.
Martin, are you on question one?
Yes. And I disagree that we should include that, because I think it is not really very helpful, because it is a kind of normal stuff. Because even in this overall disclosure requirement in B, when we give aggregation and disaggregation information provided to meet the, I think it is more an IAS 1, that is true for each and any kind of disclosure which require an IFRS standard. So I already think that what we have in paragraph 11 then B, which is an is not necessary. So I think it is a general requirement which we should have in IAS 1 already, and if we have it here, then the question is why we don't have it with other kind of disclosure requirements and other standards. And then even more than to say, but this aggregation could be done by segments. Yeah, okay. Is that helpful? I don't think so. So I don't think we should include that.
Do you
want to
try and vote on question one? Yeah?
Okay, I'm going to show hands for those support question one. 10-1 absent. So, turning to the specific disclosure objectives on defined benefit plans, the first of them is discussed in paragraphs 17 to 20 of the paper, and it's about understanding the amount in the primary financial statements that arise from defined benefit plans. Though the board's tentative decisions are not that similar to the effect of an existing objective today, we think that the board's tentative decisions would lead to more effective and concise disclosures in the notes. Therefore, we recommend that the board makes no changes to its tentative decisions in this area. And I'll turn it over to the board to discuss question two.
Comments, or can we vote? Hands for question two.
It's here. Okay. Yep, 13-1 absent.
The second specific objective is discussed in paragraphs 21 to 23 of the paper, and this is about understanding the nature and risk of defined benefit plans. This is a particular area where, when the board was making its tentative decisions, it thought that including a comprehensive list of suggestions would help to clearly communicate the intent of the objective. So to that extent, we are recommending that the board include the additional items of information in paragraph 23, which we think would be helpful in giving preparers ideas on how to meet the objective. So I'll turn it over to you to discuss and vote on question three.
Mary?
In paragraph 22, you referenced paragraph 139 of IAS 19, the first box.
Yes.
Little Roman 2 and Little Roman 3, your staff analysis was that those captured by the tentative decisions about information to meet the objective. See paragraphs 21A and C. And I didn't see where these two points were captured as clearly. And, you know, I may just be missing something in 21.
So both of them are essentially looking at the regulatory framework and the governance in that, which C was as that as an example. So we felt that it was all-encompassing in regards to the regulatory conditions you're working with.
So you're looking on page 8.
Yes.
And the second group, while not mandatory, the following items may.
Yes.
And item C.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. I think it was probably just dumbly focused more on A and C above that.
Chung Wu?
Thank you. The same paragraph as Mary said. Paragraph 142. In the middle, there was a 2011 amendment to standard because the users would like to have that kind of information. We added such a note disclosure there. However, the current users you have some kind of feedback from, they don't like it. They don't want that kind of note disclosure, right? So that's why you decided not to include those note disclosures. Isn't that right? At different users.
Yes, in the sense that it didn't come through as a, you know, a strong, we need this relative to everything else. So the short answer to your question is yes. I mean, in terms of reconciling the two sets of information, I guess for us there is an element to this which is about any piece of information I could give you about pension schemes would probably be useful in some way or another. And if you ask the question, would this be useful, the answer that comes back is often going to be yes. The way we approached all of the research we've done for this project was very much about tell us what is the most useful, tell us what you need to do and what lets you do it. And this particular item didn't come through that as a, you know, a one that we really needed. So that for me is how I'd sort of reconcile the feedback, if that helps.
Ching Chao?
Yes, I agree with staff's proposal, but I have one question. On paragraph 10.3, B2, disclosure requirements about the fair value of the entity's own transferable financial instrument, held as planned assets. I'm wondering why only focus on the transferable financial instrument. If those financial instruments not transferable, I think those fair value information also very useful because they are not transferable. How you determine, you know, and the liquidity, you know, risk there and the value. So it's also relevant information. Why distinguish the transferable financial instruments and non-transferable financial instruments?
I think they have to be transferable to qualify as plan assets.
Yeah, that's the reason.
Would they?
I think that's the requirement in 19. If it's not transferable, it wouldn't qualify as plan asset. So you wouldn't ever have a non-transferable.
So we could drop it from the qualifier.
So if there was a big piece of infrastructure that's transferable?
No, this is the entity's own financial instruments.
Okay, yeah, so it's instruments only.
We vote on question 3, or do we need to?
The third objective is discussed in paragraphs 24 to 27 of the paper, and this is about expected future cash flows resulting from the defined benefit obligation, and this is the objective that we just discussed. We think that the board's tentative decisions are likely to lead to new or increased disclosure compared to the existing requirement, and for the reasons that we describe in paragraph 27, we think the cost-benefit test is satisfied. Therefore, we recommend that the board makes no changes to its tentative decisions in this area. So I'll turn it over to you to discuss and vote on question 4.
Vote on question 4.
13, one absent.
The fourth specific disclosure objective for defined benefit plans is in paragraph 28 to 31 of the paper. And this is about understanding the time period over which payments to closed plans will continue to be made. This is an area where we think effective compliance with the objective could be achieved with less disclosure than is typically given today. And we think this is appropriate in light of the feedback we've heard from stakeholders as we describe in paragraph 29. Therefore, we recommend that the board makes no changes to its tentative decisions in this area as well. So I'll turn it over to you, the board, to discuss and vote on question five.
We vote.
Sorry, Tom.
Sorry, yeah, I continue to this. The one thing that, first of all, I like what the staff have done, because when we go back to the question about sort of limiting the irrelevant and getting more relevant, I can't think of a alternative approach to the one the staff has come up with. But if we do that, it's really important that the specific disclosure objectives be right. And I still have trouble with this, limiting this as closed to new members only. And I think in particular, at the bottom, it talks about it being more useful for these plans, but I can't think of another place where we say, this is, if you, it's useful to B and it's useful to A, but it's more useful to B, so A don't have to do it. Like, to me, the question is it useful to A, and if so, it's relevant and we should say so. And so then this one, back in the old standard, which wasn't that long ago, we said that this was relevant to all defined bench. And so my big question is, why is it no longer relevant to the open plans? And I think in particular, when I just go through and try and think why it would not be relevant, I come up with that, to me, it would be relevant. I think if you have an open plan, you would care about the maturity profile. And I think you would also, if I think about the, and this is a bit tricky, in that duration is useful for more things than just the maturity profile, but that's one of the ones that's an option. Also, I just want to come back as well, because it's a specific disclosure and we have materiality and we have the overriding objectives, and then this is a may enable, there's a lot of management discretion if they don't want to go for this. But what we're saying is don't do it the way we've made this change. And this is useful information. And if I go and I read an actuarial thing on duration, I don't see them making any distinction between open and closed plans and saying duration's more important for closed plans. The actuaries, I don't think, would talk about that. And I went through a couple of things where it's useful. One of the things you can do with it is in paragraph 83, when they talk about corporate bonds, the currency and term, duration helps you test whether the term is an appropriate term. Okay, so, and the duration is longer for open plans. So if you don't do that, then people can't assess whether the company's made a reasonable choice in its discount rate. And we know that the longer the duration, the more critical the choice of the discount rate is, because it's just more sensitive. The other thing that duration does is it also allows a relatively straightforward calculation of a pension liability sensitivity to interest rate changes. There's a fairly simple thing you can do. Again, I think that should be relevant, that people would be interested in that. So I think it should be there. And I went even in the this is a bit about the duration, seems to go a bit beyond the maturity profile, because in BC 243, they actually make the statement in the basis of the old standard as is. The disclosure of the average duration provides information similar to the maturity analysis and will enhance the usefulness of other disclosures, such as the disclosures of actuarial assumptions, which is exactly the point I was just making about the discount rate. So we didn't actually say that in the standard itself, but we said in the basis that it has these other beneficial effects. And I'm just kind of uncomfortable in saying that just don't do it if you're an open plan. I'm sympathetic to listening to the users and all that, and I would just prefer if we could take that somehow out of the specific disclosure objective, share the knowledge that you got about what the view of users are, but not say to people in open plans, because there are still some out there, that you should not do this. So that was the one place where I just remain really uncomfortable, that my understanding of duration is that it's useful in open plans.
Okay. Just in case it's helpful to comment, possibly reiterating some of what I said at the last pension meeting, for the absolute avoidance of doubt, this decision and what we've brought to the board did not say that information is not useful at all for open plans. We've very sort of carefully explained that it is more useful for closed plans and why. So as I sort of alluded to earlier, for us it's been very much about what is most important. The reason why we felt the need for it was much greater on closed plans is because we repeatedly heard from many investors that what they really care about is how long do I have to worry about this thing for? And for a closed plan, this gives them a straight answer. It just doesn't for an open plan. So we heard across our feedback that it is genuinely more useful for a closed plan. That is not to say it's not useful at all for an open plan for the reasons that you described. So if we've given that impression...
That's where I think by phrasing it the way we do, we're basically telling people not to do it, as opposed to letting them use their judgment, which is why I'd like it out of the specific objective, so that open plans can still think about it. And an interesting thing on what you said, because I agree, I think where people did talk about why being more useful for closed plans, they wanted to really know that the maturity kind of period and what it looked like. Some of the duration things, the ones I just mentioned, it's actually used for something slightly different. But it's still it's a really useful thing to be able to assess, did they use a reasonable discount rate? So anyway, that was my... I would like, if we could just bring it back to take that out, I'd be happier.
So based on the package we have at the moment, we're explicit on this objective for closed plans.
Yes.
And effectively silent on this point for open plans. Is that how it works?
Yes. So Tom's point is alluded to the fact that in our required objective, it is plans that are closed to new members. Yep. It's about the objective, which is the requirement.
Okay. Can I get a show of hands from the board on who supports question five?
The fifth specific objective is discussed in paragraphs 32 to 34 of the paper, and this is about understanding significant actuarial assumptions used in determining the defined benefit obligation. Compared to existing requirements, we think that the board's tentative decisions here would provide users with more effective information about measurement uncertainty without being too costly to prepare. Therefore, we recommend that the board makes no changes to its tentative decisions in this area. So I'll turn it over to the board to discuss and vote on question six.
Tadal.
Thank you. I have one question. Here it's paragraph 32. E. Any alternative actuarial assumptions reasonably possible at the reporting date that could have significantly changed the defined benefit obligation. It is supposed to replace sensitivity analysis we had before in paragraph 145. The point is that I understood that in the outreach, we concluded or user told us that this is not used this information is not very required, but I'm just wondering whether disclosing the alternative actuarial assumption reasonably possible would add anything. I mean that I'm using 4%, and then I would say a reasonable could be 5, could be 3. But actually, I just need to disclose what is the assumption, and then the user may analyze whether this is reasonable or not. Because even with this information, additional information, 5 or 3%, probably he wouldn't be able, she wouldn't be able to make calculations and see how much the DBO would change. That's I don't think that this information add to the user.
Okay. Again, just in case it's helpful, the use that we feel this piece of information adds is in enabling users to
understand the assumptions that have been used and make judgments around things like comparability about whether those assumptions are in line with what users would expect the assumptions used to be. So comparing to today's requirement around giving, you know, the numerical effect, if you like, what we've heard about that sort of specific element of sensitivity is that movements on one assumption individually are not really as useful as they might be in terms of feeding directly into what users want to know, which is, you know, what's the best and worst case scenario overall, because individual assumptions will interlink in ways that mean X percent movement in Y assumption has this effect. That effect doesn't mean anything and is unlikely to be feeding into any particular analysis. So that's why we felt comfortable that what is here and what the board decided on last time is a useful piece of information, and why we are sort of comfortable with the difference.
I'm not sure I agree with you on that point. I think if you look at your specific objective, it says to enable users to understand the significant actuarial assumptions. That doesn't say anything about alternative assumptions. If I give my discount rate, my compensation, growth rate.
It's what number did I use?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I mean, you're never going to, no one's going to disclose D. You know, because first of all, you say it may enable. So my discount rate is tied to the cost of funds, or I've always given 3% raises, and I'm going to continue to do that. I mean, that's, you'll never get D disclosed. In fact, you say it may enable, doesn't make it required, so it wouldn't necessarily object to being articulated, but no one's going to give you that. And you're right, they do work as a group, the assumptions. I mean, it might be individually assessed, but they do work as a group, I can assure you, is that if inflation is 2%, you're not going to be given 5% raises. You know, they really, they do hang together, you know, as a package.
Can we vote on question 6?
No. 11, one absent.
All right. What was that?
11, one absent.
The last specific objective for defined benefit plans is discussed in paragraphs 35 to 37 of the paper, and that's about understanding drivers of change in the net defined benefit liability or asset. The board's tentative decisions in this area focus only on the surplus or deficit in the statement of financial position. However, we recommend that the board refine that objective such that it's broadened to include reimbursement rights. And the reason is that these rights are also assets that relate to defined benefit plans. In addition, we recommend that the board include 3 additional examples of drivers of change. So I'll turn it over to the board to discuss and vote on question 7.
On this one, I'm just wondering how comfortable I feel about moving away from a mandatory reconciliation, because I worry when I look at the words that we've got in our disclosure objective and say that information needs to be provided to enable users to understand the drivers of change, that this might move all of the way from a reconciliation, where I appreciate users say they may not use every line item, they might only use aspects of it. But they might not like it if what they get now is just a list of the items that you've got here in the second part of paragraph 35. Somebody being cute could say, well, it was driven by, you know, contributions by employees, blah, 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 and not put numbers next to any of those things. And they've told you what the drivers were. Tick. And I'm not sure that users, so I think there could be a massive gap between a reconciliation and a very bland narrative explanation that might really not be what people had in mind when they gave us the feedback about, you know, we don't need a, you know, granular every single item identified type of reconciliation, but this might be, you know, far at the other extreme.
So you think we need a quantitative in there?
I find it hard to imagine how you would understand this other than with a reconciliation, I guess. Even if it's not hugely detailed, at least with the key numbers in there, with maybe an, you know, an other or something, but no reconciliation at all.
I'm holding back because I'm going to hazard a guess that Nick has a comment on the same subject.
So I'd also like to make a plea for retaining the requirement to have a reconciliation. And I do for two reasons. One, I guess it's a general feedback. Actually, looking at the comment letter of the 2011 agenda consultation from the CFA Institute, this was in relation to the financial statements presentation project, and there they said one of the four key items was maintaining roll forward of key balance sheet items. And then I think really in terms of particularly helping users who don't come from an accounting background understanding how the primary statements fit together, there is nothing better than a reconciliation. And so I think this is as much anything about making our statements accessible to users. It just really, you can see how the jigsaw works. And so I would be, I would have concerns about losing that as a requirement, I have to say.
Mary?
I also had marked the loss of the tabular information reconciliation of the drivers of change for the amount in the statement of financial position as something I was uncomfortable with. I think I could live without the requirement for a tabular reconciliation of the drivers of change in reimbursement rights. It's the obligation itself. And I think the point that Nick made, I think, Sue, it was you that said it, that moving from a if we kept a tabular reconciliation requirement for the amount that is shown on the statement of financial position, and we make clear that here are some of the line items that might be relevant, but you have to decide which are the line items you include. It could be a very brief or it could be a very detailed, and it depends on whether it's, you know, there's one single driver of change that explains 80% of it, or whether it's a number of different things. So I think I would not support it without keeping the reconciliation of the net balance sheet obligation.
Gary?
I came in here supporting the staff's recommendation, but listening to this, I think the table is important, or tabular. I mean, words are cheap. Numbers are what you analyze. Especially in this. But you take an actuary, they'll project out a number to the penny 40 years out from now. These numbers exist if you're running your actuarial program, your benefits the way they should be run. So it actually is very doable. You're not creating anything that would not naturally exist through actuarial processes. So I came there agreeing with you now. I think we should put this in.
Francoise?
I can understand and sympathize for the retain attraction to a table format. But then I think we should really make it clear that what we need to see in that format is in that table are the main drivers of change. So not a full table having the full list, but having.
Yep.
And then we have a nice requirement in the PFS project that say when we use the column other, we identify the biggest of those items as a disclosure. But it could be a reconciliation provided under this kind of format. You have the main drivers, you have all others together, and you just disclose the main one among the others. And you avoid these big tables where you have small numbers that, you know, which was what was, I understand, best avoided.
Okay. Catherine, do you want to say something? No, sorry.
Anything I say would repeat what was said at the last meeting in terms of making this decision. The only thing I think it would be helpful to clarify if the board are deciding whether they want to require a reconciliation or not is Francoise's description made a lot of sense to me. However, if we use the word reconciliation, if I were a preparer, I would certainly read reconciliation to mean, you know, reconcile it and, you know, a couple of important items and other can we call that a reconciliation? So if we're voting on reconciliation, I'd just like
to be clear. You've got another line item, but I think the key thing is making sure that it includes an explanation of the key sort of key drivers of change, I think, is the idea.
That's what I was going to say. If you thought about phrasing it as a tabular reconciliation that disaggregates the primary or main drivers, so you're trying to bring in that notion that it's the key
important stuff. Okay. Can we vote on that basis with that amendment? Can I get a show of hands?
Martin, you sure? Okay. 13, one absent.
12, one
absent. 12, one absent.
Okay. Sorry, could I ask just one clarification? So I think what you just voted on was about the statement of financial position. I assume the board wants to then vote separately on the question in the paper, which is about bringing in reimbursement rights. And my take from the conversation was that that would remain as a, whilst not mandatory,
narrative explanation or tabular reconciliation.
Yes, so I think we just voted for shall on the first point and
shall.
So moving on to defined contribution plans. So the board tentatively decided to only include a high-level catch-all objective for these plans. I think the information we expect companies to provide to meet this objective is similar to the information that's captured by existing requirements. And we think this is still appropriate given the stakeholder feedback that we describe in paragraph 14. So we recommend that the board makes no changes to its tentative decisions in this area. And I'll turn it over to the board to discuss and vote on question 8.
Any comments or can we vote?
13
and absent. So next up is multi-employer plans. So the board's tentative decisions differed for these plans depending on whether they're accounted for as a defined benefit plan or a defined contribution plan. And this distinction is further explained in paragraphs 43 to 45 of the paper. In comparing the board's tentative decisions with the existing requirements, we identified additional items of information that capture particular risks and characteristics unique to multi-employer plans. So we recommend that the board refine the tentative decisions to include those items which we outline in paragraph 47. So I'll turn it over to the board to discuss and vote on question 9.
Mary.
Your table on under paragraph 46, the item for 148B, I accept your analysis, but I don't know that I would have thought to read across that general requirement in this way. So my request is that you capture in the basis for conclusion the observation that we considered whether to introduce the requirement or to keep the requirement that we have in 19, but the staff analysis was that this would be picked up in those situations in which it was relevant. Because of that requirement, just so people don't think we're it's in no longer that we decided to drop it. We didn't.
Tadal?
Thank you. So it's just an explanation that I know that's here, but on paragraph 46, when explaining 148, D4, actually. D3, the expected contribution to the plan for the next annual reporting period. I'm just trying to understand why we are not also requiring, in line with paragraph 24, to disclose the expected future contributions for this one. It's just why for this we are going towards a more qualitative disclosure, but when we are assessing a peer defined benefit plan, I require the disclosure of the expected future contributions. Why I'm making this distinction?
It's essentially because with multi-employer plans, the information that we understand to be really key is that which explains what is the company whose financial statements we're talking about exposure to the bigger plan that someone else holds. And so we very much focused on those items, whereas information like this that is more along the lines of our whole set of information for DB schemes would be more about the scheme in its entirety than this entity's particular exposure.
I think that at the end of the day is the same cash flow. It's just because in one it's my own plan, mm-hmm. in another one it's a multi-employer plan.
I mean, we are talking about companies that are accounting for these as defined contribution rather than defined benefits. So it is very much that they will be just accounting for the amount going in every year. So we don't think the full set of DB disclosures.
It is a multi-employer.
In paragraph 43, you apply everything that you
find. If it's being accounted for as a DB scheme, everything will be in. So the circumstance in which, you know, our staff analysis applies and that isn't in is when the entity and the set of financial statements in question is treating this as a DC scheme. So then the items we focused on are those which explain, you know, what is the exposure beyond a DC exposure.
Okay.
Vote on question 9.
14, one absent.
Okay. So moving on to group plans. The board's tentative decisions are similar to those the board made for multi-employer plans. However, the existing disclosure requirements for group plans are much more detailed than the board's tentative decisions, especially in the case for group plans that are accounted for as defined contribution plans. On the basis of our analysis in paragraph 52, we think the board should refine its tentative decisions, but to only include the additional items of information that we outline in paragraph 53A of the paper. In addition, we recommend that the board refine its tentative decisions to incorporate the notion of cross-referencing. So with that, I'll turn it over to the board to discuss and vote on question 10.
We vote.
13, one absent.
Finally, on other employee benefit plans, and that is short-term employee benefits, other long-term employee benefits, and termination benefits. Similar to defined contribution plans, the board tentatively decided to only include a high-level catch-all objective so that relevant information is provided when these plans are material. There are no specific disclosure requirements in IAS 19 today for these plans. But for the reasons that we describe in paragraph 57, we recommend that the board makes no changes to its tentative decisions. So I'll turn it over to the board to discuss and vote on the last question, which is question 11.
We vote.
Can I just make one? Yeah, sorry. In relation to termination benefit, we are not making any requirement.
There is the high-level objective, which is at the bottom of page 29.
Okay. Then I have no question. Sorry about that.
It's okay.
13, one absent.
What was the last?